Health Action here on listener-supported community radio WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, director of Metro New York Healthcare for All and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week. In this week's program, we're going to be doing a little bit of catch-up because we've been off the air for a few weeks for the Spring Fun Drive. And thank you, everybody, for all your support for the station. It makes it possible for us to keep bringing programs like Health Action to you every week. So the major catch-up, we're going to be doing one on what's been happening around the major healthcare bills that are in development and moving forward in various ways in the Congress. And then in the second half of the program, we're going to be taking a look at recent developments about the future of Beth Israel Hospital on Manhattan's Lower East Side and how the community is beginning to mobilize. But first, we'll start with the Health Action news for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. The Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call reports that Republican senators return this week from a 10-day recess with immediate decisions to make on their quest to overhaul the Affordable Care Act. While Senate leaders have largely avoided putting any artificial timelines on their endeavor, the Republicans are under an extreme time crunch to produce and advance their own legislation to match the House bill that narrowly passed that chamber last month. Some members, however, are now openly doubting whether Republicans can follow through on their 7-year effort to repeal and replace former President Barack Obama's signature domestic achievement. Senate Majority Whip John Cornyn of Texas said in an interview with a local radio station recently that work on the effort would be done in the chamber by July at the latest. That aligns with the view of several staff aides who say that a vote on the bill would likely occur before the August recess, regardless of whether there are enough votes to pass it. Addressing the legislation in that time frame would allow the Senate to return from the August break in the fall and immediately tackle a number of impending deadlines. Aside from the Republicans' ambitious legislative agenda, which includes an overhaul of the U.S. tax code, Congress must also soon turn to funding the government through for fiscal year 2018 and addressing the approaching debt ceiling deadline, among other issues. However, coming to consensus on an overhaul of the healthcare system could now become an even harder task. Before the recess, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell alluded to the difficulty Republicans are facing in mustering up the necessary votes. Now lawmakers return to Washington, having spent the last week in their home states, where they were expected to hear from both constituents and business leaders about the effort. Senator Bill Cassidy, for example, was grilled on the health care issues at a town hall. The Louisiana Republican was one of only a few senators to actually hold one over the recess. Those interactions are sure to play a part in how lawmakers attempt to influence the legislation. However, back home, some Republican lawmakers are already casting doubts on the chamber's efforts. Politico reports that the once powerful health insurance lobby, the same one that killed Hillary Care a generation ago and yet also helped to usher in Obamacare, can't pick a side in the latest battle over America's healthcare system. Some major players of the sprawling trillion-dollar industry, like Humana and Cigna, have little at stake in the fight. Other insurers heavily invested in the new marketplaces, like regional nonprofit Blue Cross Blue Shield plans, are urging Congress to fix the law instead of shredding it. And then there's Anthem, a rare industry voice supporting repeal. The result is that the insurance lobby has lost influence and is now struggling to mount a united front against Republican efforts to push through an Affordable Care Act replacement bill. At the same time, the Trump administration has ignored the industry's pleas to stabilize the health insurance benefit marketplaces in the short term, which could send wobbly insurance markets crashing before they agree on a health care plan. Industry officials and allies push back strongly against suggestions that their trade organization lobby, known as America's Health Insurance Plans, or AHIP, has been weakened. They argue that AHIP has picked its battles carefully, enabling lobby groups to maintain communication with the Trump administration and lawmakers. The health insurance lobby has fewer resources after losing some large companies as members recently. AHIP has also seen a wholesale turnover of senior leadership following the departure of its longtime CEO a couple of years ago. That upheaval has been made tougher by the diverging interests among its remaining members. In general, insurers generally have two major problems with the repeal bill that passed the House last month. They think its tax credits to help low-income Americans purchase coverage are too late, a program that's been increasingly lucrative for them. However, insurers aren't happy with the status quo either. They've lost billions of dollars on their new Affordable Care Act customers, and some of the biggest plans have abandoned the marketplaces. And finally, The Hill reports that state insurance commissioners are pulling out all the stops to keep insurers from leaving their states. They're offering insurers new, previously unheard-of flexibilities to try to keep them in the market. However, the effort faces an uphill climb given the Trump administration's wobbling over whether it will continue federal payments that compensate insurers for subsidizing out-of-pocket costs for lower-income households. There's also a question of whether Congress will actually repeal the Affordable Care Act this year. Insurers are skittish and pleading for certainty from Washington. They want assurances that they will continue to receive cost-sharing reduction payments from the federal government, which total about $7 billion this year. However, no such promise appears forthcoming, prompting state insurance commissioners to try to hold things together with later filing deadlines for enrollment and new concessions to insurers. The biggest fear of state insurance commissioners is having every carrier pull out of a market, leaving people with no private health plans to buy. It's a situation that hasn't happened before, but could happen this year. Insurers are facing imminent deadlines in many states to submit their preliminary premium requests and state whether they'll stay in the market next year. They also face a June 21st deadline to tell the federal government whether they'll be participating. According to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, some states could look to follow the lead of Alaska, which is creating its own reinsurance program. Such programs usually involve a mix of federal and state money to help stabilize insurance companies' payments on high-cost claims. This type of state-based arrangement is popular with the Trump administration, and the new Department of Health and Human Services Secretary, Dr. Tom Price, has encouraged other states to adopt similar approaches. Republican lawmakers say the Affordable Care Act's insurance marketplaces are in a death spiral, with their repeal effort aimed at saving the country from a failing law. However, Democrats say Republicans are purposely trying to make the new system collapse. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first segment, taking a more in-depth look at what's happening in Congress around health care reform, repeal, and replace. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. We're going to be doing a little bit of catch-up in this segment since it's been about a month since we've been on the air because of the Spring Fund Drive. And again, thanks to everybody who helped support that and keep the station going. There's been a lot happening in Washington around health care, and we're going to be playing a bit of catch-up on that. When we last spoke about this topic on the program, the House had not been able to gather the votes it needed to move forward with its health care reform, Affordable Care Act repeal and replace bill, but there were some big changes that happened since then. So let's start at that point. Joining us is Margarita George, who is the National Co-Director with Health Care for America Now, and Mary Clark, who's the Southern Tier Regional Director with Citizen Action of New York. Welcome to Health Action, Margarita and Mary.
Hello.
Thanks.
Margarita, let's start with you. So what exactly happened at the very end of April, beginning of May? All of a sudden, something came out of the blue and they were able to move forward. What were the policy changes that they made in order to do that? And what was the politics behind it?
Sure. Well, people, folks might remember that there was a lot of debate around the bill, and the central challenge that the Republicans were facing in the House is that there's this pretty wide division between moderate Democrats that want to do, you know, terrible things to health care in America, but not things that are not as terrible as what the Freedom Caucus would like to do, which is the most sort of extreme set of Republicans in the House. And so the key challenge that they were facing, and frankly, this is still a challenge now, this is sort of a prevailing political dynamic that we are seeing among Republicans in the House and in the Senate, is how to get to a compromise that dismantles the Affordable Care Act in the way that conservatives really want pieces of the law gone, while at the same time not going so far that legislators would face repercussions from their constituents. And so leading up, it sounds like you folks last talked when Speaker Paul Ryan had to pull the vote because he didn't actually have enough votes. And what happened subsequent to that was a number of Republicans took leadership in creating some amendments that would undo a few specific things. Now, the bill already had a lot of, you know, really dangerous provisions in it around the rolling back of the Medicaid expansion, structural changes to the traditional Medicaid program, vast numbers of uninsured people that were going to result. But one thing that was not clear that the Republicans were going to go after were provisions that are more regulatory. And so these are things like the protections, the rules that the ACA created that stopped insurers from discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions, that stopped insurers from being able to sell policies that didn't cover what regular folks out there might think of as pretty basic services like hospitalization and prescriptions and maternity care and physical therapy. The MacArthur Amendment, Representative MacArthur out of New Jersey, was a compromise amendment that basically was added to the law that would allow states to opt out of the protections for pre-existing conditions and the essential health benefits. And so that was a really, that was a really critical, sort of the critical move that won over a lot of the Freedom Caucus, was doing away with that insurance protection against pre-ex and being able to water down the essential health benefit, which then, you know, would allow insurers to essentially, in states that got the waiver, sell any kind of coverage that they wanted that didn't even cover some of these basic things. There was a subsequent amendment, once they started to get some pushback around that, from Representative Long and Representative Upton. Representative Upton of Michigan has long been an opponent of the ACA. He's led many repeal efforts in the past. When Upton got into a leadership, sort of took leadership in the amendment and proposed that the way that we would deal with all of the problems that would ensue from taking away the protection for pre-existing conditions, his amendment would have added some small amount of money to the high-risk pools. And so essentially his amendment was saying we could trade these guaranteed provisions that really stop insurance companies from taking away coverage from people with pre-ex, which is a lot of people. And we can instead just do this high-risk pool thing. And, of course, folks that know high risks know it's been tried in a lot of places and really hasn't been very successful. And so ultimately, with the addition of those two amendments, the bill went to the floor and it was able to pass. It was at 217 to 214 was the vote. A number of Republicans did vote against the bill. A number of moderates voted against the bill, but it just wasn't enough to stop it from passage. It passed by 3 votes.
Mary, how did things fall out here in New York around all that? We have, across the state, 9 members of Congress who are members of the House Republican majority. What happened with all that?
What happened with all that? We only 2 congressmen voted against it. It was Representative Katko in the Syracuse area and Representative Donnelly in Staten Island region. So we commend them for protecting New Yorkers, because New York State will be extremely affected by this, and I can tell you more about it. But those were the 2 representatives who on Staten Island and in Syracuse area. all the rest of the 9 Republicans voted for it, and our entire Democratic congressional delegation voted against it,
and
along with Katko and Donnelly.
Donovan, yes.
Donovan, sorry.
No problem. It's close enough. Some of the Republicans said they voted for it just to kind of get things moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Who are they here in New York?
Well, I think, you know, Representative King on Long Island was saying, well, we just want to move it forward so we get it moving into the Senate and let them do their stuff. So it was primarily, and a couple other ones like Penny, Reed, even Faso indicated that, you know, well, let's move it on to the Senate and just negate, you know, having responsibilities of the adverse effects it will have. And so they were the among the ones, and Stefanik as well. Many of them actually said we're just moving it onto the Senate. And we think that was kind of an irresponsible vote for the impact we'll have here in New York.
And what is the impact projected to be here in New York should this bill become law?
I mean, the most serious things is what what is being proposed for Medicaid. And what we find, they talk about some $800 billion in Medicaid cuts to the program. And what that does in New York, about a quarter of a million people were on the Medicaid expansion. The funding for that all go away here in New York. We have the essential plan in New York that allowed many working families to buy low cost or no cost, $0 to $20 a month care. That was about 700,000 people here in New York. So we're talking about almost a million people who are going to lose their coverage because the funding goes away for those two vital programs that cover almost a million people. In addition to that, the other Medicaid cuts will adversely affect our hospitals. Many upstate hospitals, particularly in rural communities, are barely hanging on now. And this level of cuts to Medicaid funding are going to devastate our whole hospital system throughout New York State, as well as long-term care. Majority of long-term care is paid for by Medicaid. That's our seniors who are in nursing homes, our seniors who are not in nursing homes in terms of getting home care to keep them out of nursing homes. Majority of that is funded by Medicaid. All of those services, all of that money gets severely, severely cut, and that means cuts to our hospitals, our nursing homes, and our home care system.
Yeah, and people with disabilities also rely on those programs very heavily.
Absolutely.
Right.
You know, it's really affecting, you know, when 46% of our children are covered by Medicaid, so it affects children, seniors, disabled. It's just the most vulnerable of all our populations are going to be the most severely affected here in New York. And in addition, the million or so New Yorkers who will just lose their benefits through Medicaid as well as the essential plan. And the other factors are they're estimating about 5.1 million New Yorkers will be affected by rate increases or by loss of coverage. And so this is a real serious problem and really, as I said before, irresponsible that our representatives voted for this bill without even knowing what the Congressional Budget Office said the effects will be. And now we know for sure what the effects will be, and they're really bad for New York.
Margarita, so the House has done its thing for a while. Now the Senate is taking things up. What's happening over on that side of the Capitol?
Well, it's a little bit, it's a little bit like a bad rerun, to be honest. You know, the House, I think you guys are totally right. They rushed, what Mary said is right, they rushed it through. They wanted to pass the buck because, you know, keep in mind that the Republicans had the intention of having this repeal done in January, and here it is June, and it's not even halfway done. we've been hearing for quite some time that the senators had been in discussions over the last month and that we were to expect a bill, their version of repeal in the Senate, to come out this week. And of course, now the recess is over, the members are back up to D.C., and what we're hearing a lot of is an adjustment of expectations, and quite a fair number of Republican leaders in the Senate saying, I don't know if we're going to get to an agreement. And so even in the Senate, which is really considered politically to be the more moderate body of the two, there is significant difficulty with getting to agreement on a policy proposal. You know, at the when the AHCA passed in the House, many folks said the Republicans are going to start from scratch. This bill is so terrible; it's dead on arrival. What were some of the comments that were being made? But over the course of the last month, it's really clear that advocates are going to have to stay pretty vigilant, because my prediction is that quite a lot of the stuff that we saw in the AHCA, which is some of the worst, pieces that Mary just mentioned, will ultimately end up in the Senate bill. And a lot of that is, frankly, because of politics, because they need to put in some things that the Freedom Caucus is going to support. Remember that whatever happens in the Senate, if they come up with a bill and it gets to the floor and they vote on it, it's got to go back over to the House. And it's got to be acceptable enough in the House that the House will support it. So right now we're just waiting. We expect that, you know, the leader McConnell continues to say that they're expecting to have some progress and get something done over the summer. Initially, he was saying that they would have a bill passed by the August recess. Already we're seeing a slowdown in the timeline, so it's not clear whether that's going to happen or not. It's very possible. An optimistic scenario would be that they have to continue to deal with these delays because they can't get to agreement amongst themselves. We'll see.
What's the process formally that's in motion in the Senate?
Well, formally, they would, actually introduce a bill. The help committee would introduce a bill. But they say, actually, this week, the press reports are telling us that they're not even at the point yet where committees can introduce a bill, that what we would expect to see this week is just a sort of a dribbling of ideas of, and they're talking about the development of their legislation in a series of categories, four or five buckets of things. And so they'll share information. The process is not as open as we have seen in past administrations. There's a lot of secrecy. There's been one hearing, but not the number of public hearings and expert testimony and such that we're used to seeing. We expect that that the House will try to move this bill through the reconciliation process, which then prevents them from having to get 60 votes. They only have to get 51 votes. So in the Senate, what Democrats would need to do is move a couple of their Republican colleagues against the bill. The Democrats have to get 51 votes. Or conversely, the Republicans have to get 51 votes in order to pass the bill. So it's not the process. The timeline is really unclear. The process is very similar to what we saw in the House. If they pass something in the Senate, it's sort of widely the prevailing wisdom is that Senator McConnell, the House Majority Leader, will not bring a bill to the floor unless he's got the votes. And so we shouldn't expect that we'll see a bill until they're pretty close to having really strong agreement on it, because it's going to be to their advantage to not have too much lag time between the time that they announce their bill and the bill goes to the floor. And really, because we're working through this expedited reconciliation process, there won't be really much of an amendment process. It'll, you know, the bill could be introduced one day and then 48 hours later could be voted on. Once they actually introduce the bill,
Mary, where do our senators in New York fall on all this?
Our senators are completely on our side in trying to stop the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. They understand how devastating these cuts will be to New York, and we commend them and encourage them to continue to fight strong on the stopping of the repeal of this. And Senator Schumer and both Senator Gillibrand are really out there fighting for us. And we're hoping Senator Schumer, with his leadership position, will be able to work and persuade other senators and to see how bad this is for us here in New York, but it affects other states equally as bad.
Yes, I was at a press conference that Senator Gillibrand did last month shortly after the House bill, and her main point that she made at that press conference was for people to keep up all the activism that's going on and to keep calling her office and in particular sharing their personal stories with her, that she needed that sort of as ammunition. Sort of going to that, one thing we haven't mentioned is that the bill not only affects the Affordable Care Act and the Medicaid program, which we've talked about, but also family planning and Planned Parenthood in particular. Margarita, what do the Republican women senators say about that?
Well, sadly, not much. They're pretty much telling the line. I mean, we have had some senators, and not just the Republican women, but we have had both men and women talk about, express concerns about the end of Medicaid and family planning. And some of those concerns are about health care. And frankly, some of those concerns are about politics, right? They understand that women are an incredibly important part of the electorate, right? Half the electorate are women. Women vote at higher rates than men. Women tend to be the ones navigating healthcare, not just for themselves, but for the whole family. And so when you go after Medicaid, you totally destroy family planning because it's the largest payer of family planning. And within that, Planned Parenthood is the largest provider of family planning services. Another thing to think about is that, Medicaid, if we're talking family planning, isn't just the largest payer of contraception and the prevention of birth. It's also the largest payer of birth. Most babies, half of babies in America are financed. Those births are financed through Medicaid. And so it's incredibly important. We have had a number of senators Toomey in Pennsylvania, for instance, who have expressed reservations publicly and said this is really a terrible idea. We should not be going after family planning and Medicaid. And I think we're going to hear more of that, particularly from senators in big rural states, because in a lot of states, Planned Parenthood is the only provider for miles and miles and miles around of any kind of health care, family planning or otherwise.
The other thing that sort of throws more gasoline on the fire, if you will, is last week the Trump administration, or maybe it was 2 weeks by now, put out a proposal around their federal budget for the coming year. What does that budget say about health care, Margarita?
Well, it's terrible. Even if we didn't have this standalone effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act and restructure Medicaid, which the restructuring of Medicaid is hidden in the ACA repeal, in the budget, the restructuring of Medicaid is out in the open. And so the budget essentially says, yes, we want, not only are we for the AHCA, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act and the $800 billion in cuts,
on Thursday, June 8th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., Pacifica Radio will provide 3 hours of gavel-to-gavel analysis of former FBI Director James Comey's testimony before the United States Senate Intelligence Committee. The coverage will be produced by Pacifica's Washington, D.C. station, WPFW.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own my special interest.
Something else that's important to note in terms of the context, which is the big academic medical centers here in New York, so Mount Sinai is certainly one, and the systems that they've created are bulking up, acquiring more and more hospitals, while and making money, I should say. Most recently, Crane's Health Pulse just reported, I think it was last week, that the Mount Sinai system posted a $206 million gain last year. It's not called a profit because these hospitals are for not for profit, but it's a surplus, and basically it means they're making money. At the same time, we have New York City Health Plus Hospitals, which is the public hospital system here in the city, is losing buckets of money. So we have real disparities taking place between the private, nonprofit, academic medical center-led systems and the public hospital system in New York.
And the public system is where everyone goes who doesn't have insurance otherwise, among other folks. So they have a huge burden that they have to carry that some
That's
of
right.
the academic medical centers do some of, but not necessarily a whole lot of. So that's the kind of larger context. What has Beth Israel actually proposed in terms of its transformation? I mean, Mount Sinai is proposed for Beth Israel, yes.
Sure. what they propose for Beth Israel is what they call a transformation. And really what it amounts to is closing the existing Beth Israel Medical Facility, which is on 1st Avenue and 16th Street. It has, as I mentioned, 800-plus beds, has an ER. The ER gets about 90,000 visits a year, so it's extremely well used. And in place of the existing hospital, Mount Sinai would put a much smaller replacement hospital with 70 beds and an ER. So they'd be going from, on paper, 800 beds, although really only about half of those are used at any one time. But even then, from 400 down to 70 beds, and they would still have an ER. Some of the care that's been being delivered in the existing Beth Israel facility would then, and already is, move out into the community, into ambulatory care centers and doctor's practices. There is a plan underway to take Mount Sinai's existing facility in Union Square, which had been called the Phillips Ambulatory Surgery Center, and build it out into a really big, robust, urgent care center. And there, patients from the Lower East Side, or at least in that existing area right around there, could go and get urgent care. So really, you're looking at the transformation from a hospital-based system to a much smaller hospital and a lot of ambulatory care centers spread out all over Lower Manhattan.
So what's has anything moved forward actually yet on this so-called transformation and downsizing?
Well, as Beth Israel works on this project, they've been gradually closing some units of the existing hospital piece by piece. So already they've closed 31 chemical dependency beds, 26 physical medicine and rehab beds, several other units of the hospital, and they have pending before the state now applications to close the entire maternity service, as well as a pediatric unit, and to decertify, in other words, close all of their cardiac surgery adult services at Beth Israel.
Now, they also have a large mental health, behavioral health component. What's going to be happening to that?
That is unclear. And we hope to hear more about their plans for that at a hearing coming up on Thursday. Mount Sinai officials have held some community meetings in the affected area to try to explain their plans. I've been to some of them. And they have a very impressive presentation that, you know, seems to make sense when you listen to it. But then, as I've heard members of the community get up and ask questions and talk about it, questions arise. There are a lot of what appear to be unanswered questions about the proposal. For example, suppose you are a pregnant woman living near Mount Sinai Beth Israel Hospital or somewhere in the lower part of Manhattan. You've been expecting to deliver your baby at the maternity unit at Beth Israel. Your OBGYN has privileges there. Now, if the maternity ward closes, and officials wanted to close it last month, so they're really eager to get that closed. Their idea is that the woman, the pregnant woman, when it's time for her to deliver the baby, would then travel way uptown to either Mount Sinai's main hospital, which is on East 96th and Madison Avenue, or way over to the west side to Mount Sinai's west campus, used to be Roosevelt Hospital. That's at 59th and 10th. So you can see that's quite distant. And those of us who are familiar with rush hour traffic here in Manhattan are a little worried about whether that could happen efficiently. And frankly, it then leaves the woman way uptown delivering the baby when many of her friends and immediate neighbors will be way downtown. So there's questions to be asked about this.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the community's reaction, because I've been to a couple of the meetings, too, and heard the presentation. And again, it all kind of sounds good in theory, but then when you begin to look at the details, like, well, what if this and what if that and what if the other thing, they haven't really had a lot of answers to those questions beyond sort of broad platitudes, has been my experience so far.
Many of the public officials that represent that area, like City Council Health Committee Chair Corey Johnson and some of the state legislators that represent that area, have really been pushing hard for what's called a community needs assessment. In other words, an in-depth look at what the needs are of that population that now uses Beth Israel, so that more intelligent decisions could be made about this plan. And, you know, state officials could get a better idea of whether this is really going to work.
Several years ago now, when St. Vincent's Hospital closed in the village, everyone was promised that, don't worry, you have Beth Israel to go to. So now in this downsizing transformation that's going to be happening with Beth Israel, it sort of leaves the whole lower half of Manhattan sitting there thinking, where do we go for care?
Yeah. Well, those who live near the former St. Vincent's Hospital know that it's now become luxury condos. And that may end up being, frankly, a portion of what happens to the Beth Israel current facility as well. You know, that's a very potentially lucrative real estate deal there. But the patients who live next to the former St. Vincent's now have this option of this Lenox Hill freestanding ER. And I do know some people who have received care there, and, you know, it seems to be okay. But if you need anything that requires, suppose you go into the ER and they discover you need inpatient care, then you get transferred up to Lenox Hill Hospital on the Upper East Side, which is, again, not that convenient for people who live in the village and have friends and neighbors there who would support them. Elsewhere in Lower Manhattan, we would be left with NYU, on East 30, whatever,
31st 30th Street. And 1st Avenue, yeah.
30th and 1st Avenue. You'd have Bellevue. And then there's a Columbia Presbyterian downtown hospital way down in the financial district that is undergoing somewhat of a makeover itself. So I've heard people who live in the Lower East Side, especially in some of the housing projects there, say, you know, they're skeptical that they could go to NYU because the ambulances, they say, don't bring patients who have Medicaid as their coverage to NYU.
They take them to Bellevue, yeah.
Yeah. So there's obviously going to be quite a bit of disruption, to say the least, in the healthcare options for people who live in Lower Manhattan.
Now, you mentioned this hearing that's coming up later this week. Before we get to the particulars of that, who's overseeing this process? What's happening? Can just Mount Sinai do this sort of wholesale on their own, or who are they accountable to?
Well, good question. The State Health Department, of course, licenses hospitals and oversees their transformation. There is a process called Certificate of Need, or CON, that exists in New York and 35 other states, through which hospitals must seek state approval for major, what are called transactions. So if a new hospital is to be built, the state CON program gives it a yes or no, can attach conditions to it. If hospital is going to merge, yes, that has to go through the CON process. But unfortunately, the process has not been updated to address the current market needs. So CON was created at a time when hospitals were building like crazy, adding new wings, building new buildings, buying new equipment, and the idea was to make sure they didn't spend so much money that then our healthcare costs would go up to pay for all of it. We're in a very different time period now with consolidation, mergers, downsizings, closings, and transformations like what's occurring with Beth Israel. And the CON process isn't really very well suited to this. So what's happened so far with the Beth Israel transformation is that Mount Sinai officials have been submitting individual, narrowly tailored CON applications to close units of the hospital. And because they are so narrowly tailored, they slide through the loophole of being required to receive only DOH staff approval instead of going to what's called full CON review by the state's Public Health and Health Planning Council. So my organization, MergeWatch, and many of the public officials representing the Lower Manhattan population have complained to the state saying, this isn't right. Mount Sinai should be required to submit one big plan that would explain how they're going to close Beth Israel and what they're going to replace it with, and that should go to full CON review by this council. So in response, the state officials have put this whole application process on the agenda for this Thursday at 1 p.m. at a special meeting of the Public Health and Health Planning Council. Be taking place in the New York State DOH offices at 90 Church Street on the fourth floor. People can show up and listen. There's going to be a presentation by Mount Sinai officials and some analysis by state DOH staff of what they have heard from Mount Sinai. And then there'll be an opportunity for the rest of us, the members of the public, to comment. If people do want to testify, it's best if they try to sign up ahead of time with the New York State DOH folks.
And how can people do that? Or is there a phone number or something to call?
They can go on the New York State Department of Health website and look for CON, And there they can find an announcement about the meeting and information about how to sign up.
Now, unfortunately, this meeting is going to be held during the regular workday, so I'm a little skeptical about how many, you know, sort of regular everyday community people are going to be able to show up and hear the presentation and comment on it. Is there any way that this regulatory body of the states can be encouraged, if not forced, to do something in the community, say, during evening hours or weekends when people can actually come?
Well, that's certainly been a request from many of us who've been taking a hard look at the CON process in New York and its application in cases like the Mount Sinai Beth Israel one. It's our recommendation that whenever a proposal is made to close a hospital like this, the state would require a community hearing, in fact, maybe more than one community hearing, in the affected area in the evening or on weekends, because we recognize that trying to show up in the middle of a workday in Lower Manhattan is just not possible for many people who would have something valuable to contribute.
Is there any role that the city can play in this process, city officials, or that they are playing? You mentioned they're having some conversations with Mount Sinai administration, but beyond that?
Well, officially, the city doesn't have a role in this certificate of need process, but many of the city officials who represent that area are quite concerned about it. I think the City Public Advocate's Office and perhaps Letitia James herself will be making some comments at Thursday's hearing. And I know Corey Johnson, who represents that area, is very eager to weigh in. It would be our recommendation that the CON process be updated not only through better transparency and better consumer engagement, as we were speaking about with public meetings in the evening, but also through the introduction of better community-level planning. Mary Bassett, the Commissioner of Health for the City of New York, is extremely knowledgeable, and it would be ideal if her department could be empowered, in fact, charged to take a look at proposals like this and weigh them against city, you know, plans for health for its citizens.
The other a thing that I have heard is that Manhattan Borough President Gail Brewer has convened an informal task force of the local, state, and local officials from that catchment area for the hospital, and they've met a couple times and are beginning to sort of strategize. And there has been a community meeting that took place to sort of form a bit of a counter complementing force to the elected officials, where community members could be working together. That was about a month ago. You and I were both there. What was that meeting like?
Well, there was a pretty great turnout, I would say, over 100 people on a weeknight. It was hosted by the Progressive Action Network of Lower Manhattan, and also very active in hosting it was Commission on the Public's Health System. These groups have been alarmed by what's happening to our healthcare system in Lower Manhattan, you know, dating back, of course, to the closing of St. Vincent's, but now aggravated by worry over what's going to happen as Beth Israel transforms itself. So I think it's a really good sign that so many people showed up and were really interested in mobilizing and trying to make their concerns heard to the people who have the power to tell Mount Sinai, you know, whether the plans they've put forward make sense for downtown or perhaps they should be altered in some way. It's not uncommon for certificate of need proposals to get approval, but with contingencies attached that require the applicant to do certain things. And so that's something we're really looking at in the case of the Mount Sinai Beth Israel application.
Great. We'll be getting an update here on the situation in lower part of Manhattan with the proposed transformation, as Mount Sinai terms it, of Beth Israel Hospital. Our guest has been Lois Utley, director of Merger Watch. Just one maybe last quick repeat, how people can engage in this community hearing that's happening on Thursday, June 8th. Is there a way, if they can't attend, they could submit a letter or some written testimony?
The meeting is taking place on Thursday at 1 o'clock at 90 Church Street on the fourth floor in the offices of the New York State Department of Health. That will be webcast online. You can find that webcast on the New York State Department of Health website. You can also submit comments on any pending certificate of need application through the New York State Department of Health website. If people have trouble and are confused about how to do this, they can email us at info@mergerwatch.org.
Great. Thank you so much. Our guest has been Lois Utley, director of Merger Watch. Thank you, Lois, for joining us on Health Action.
Sure. Thank you.
And that'll do it for this week's Health Action program. Next week, we'll be coming back. Catherine Davis and I will be here. I'll be planning a segment about an upcoming conference that'll be taking a look at the history of the AIDS activist movement here in New York City as the ACT UP movement celebrates its 30th anniversary. So we'll catch you here back next time, next week. Thanks for joining us here on Health Action. I'm Mark Hanning.
Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. And I think that the show, I dare say the show ended a bit early. There was a glitch in the middle, and I do not know what caused it. I don't think it was my fault, but at least we were able to get it going, and you heard the vast majority of the show. There may have been about 2 minutes missing. But at any rate, we have about 6 minutes or 5 minutes before the following program, and we are going to listen to some promotional materials.
Hi, it's Marie Faustin from Tall Tales in the Big City. On Wednesday, June 14th at 7 p.m., join me and Katie Halper at Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue, for some stories, some stand-up, some karaoke. Get your $10 tickets by going to give2wbai.org and typing Katie and Marie in the search box. Once again, that's Wednesday, June 14th at 7 p.m., Brooklyn Commons at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Two lucky listeners will get to tell a story on stage with us. Don't forget to get your $10 tickets today. And of course, don't forget to listen to Tall Tales in the Big City every Thursday from 7 to 8 p.m. on WBAI New York 99.5.
Wait a minute. Hi, this is Virginia White from Earth, Wind & Fire, and you're listening to The Sweet Spot on WBAI.
Thursday, June 15th at 10 p.m., Baby K from The Sweet Spot teams up with DJ Spinna in a tribute to the mighty force of musical ascension known as Earth, Wind, and Fire. We'll be featuring an interview we did with bassist Verdine White and also chopping it up with Spinna as he plays some of his favorite Earth, Wind, and Fire tracks. That's The Sweet Spot, Thursday, June 15th at 10 p.m., only on WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored community radio.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale. On Tuesday, June 20th, my guest on Ecologic will be meteorologist Tom Weissmuller, who will predict this summer's weather and hurricane season and explain how El Niños and La Niñas in the western Pacific Ocean and storms in the western Sahara Desert will affect our weather. That's Tuesday, June 20th at 8 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Frankly, if we don't change this system as a species, we're not going to be here.
Christopher Hedges. Tune into the WBAI Evening News at 6 p.m. for Notes from the Left Forum, a conference which looked at questions of power, strategy, and tactics as the resistance to Donald Trump and his associates who have seized power is growing. Dr. Jill Stein.
In the same way you can say kindly and gently to a friend who is trapped in an abusive personal relationship, that we got a problem here with the Democratic Party.
Tune in at 6 p.m. on the WBAI Evening News. Here's Code Pink's Medea Benjamin.
It sometimes gets very hard working in the left because it feels sometimes like a circular firing squad. And we are constantly backbiting each other. We are constantly saying that somebody is not politically correct enough or doesn't do this enough or whatever it is. You know what we need in our movement? We need a lot more kindness. We need a lot more gentleness.
That's Notes from the Left Forum this week on the WBAI Evening News at 6 p.m. Tune in.
On Thursday, June 8th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., Pacifica Radio will provide 3 hours of gavel-to-gavel analysis of former FBI Director James Comey's testimony before the United States Senate Intelligence Committee. The coverage will be produced by Pacifica's Washington, D.C. station, WPFW, with contributors from WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles. Immediately following the committee hearings, there will be commentary and analysis by experts in the area, many unlikely to be featured in mainstream media coverage of the hearing. Listeners may tune in to WBAI 99.5 FM on Thursday, June 8th, starting at 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Pacifica Radio coverage of the Comey testimony. On Thursday, June 8th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., Pacifica Radio will provide 3 hours of gavel-to-gavel analysis of former FBI.
When you think of the golden age of radio, you're bound to remember the performer whose hold on the heartstrings of America spanned almost three generations.
Well, thank you, Jack. Yes, it's Max Schmid, and I'm your host for the Golden Age of Radio. Sunday nights at 7 p.m. here on WBAI, presenting the finest in radio's history, comedy, drama, mysteries, science fiction. Won't you join me Sunday nights at 7 for the Golden Age of Radio? Only here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
I hope you feel.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country. A media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment. My name is Jim Freund. Did you miss us? Okay, a lot of catching up this morning. Some movie reviews, talking about attending the Nebula Awards, some remarks about new media, and listening to one of this year's Nebula Award short story finalists. Stay tuned.
Loved the same man once
a sailor of me. But he was not a sailor who sailed on the wide blue sea. He sailed in an airship, sailed like a bird on the wing. And every evening at midnight, he would come to my window and sing. Come take a trip in my airship, come sail away to the stars. We'll travel to Venus, we'll sail away to Mars. No one will see while we're kissing, no one will know as we swoon. So come take a trip in my airship, and we'll visit the man in the moon. Sailing away from the clouds, we passed through the milky white way. While idly drifting, watching the clouds, he asked if I'd name the day. Just by the dipper I gave him my heart, the sun shone on our honeymoon. We swore to each other we never would part, and we teach all the babies this tune. Come take a trip in my airship, come sail away to the stars. We'll travel to Venus, we'll sail away to Mars. No one will see while we're
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. What can you say about a film that is as undemanding as Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2? It wants you to have a good time, and you do. If you love the first film, which I did, you're going to have a ball with this next chapter. That's not an inconsiderable achievement. Lots of films want to be fun and just don't cut it. I think it says something to this cast's particular alchemy. They're all back, by the way. Chris Pratt, Zoe Saldana, Dave Bautista, Karen Gillan, Michael Rooker, Bradley Cooper, and Vin Diesel doing voice work, the whole bit. It also says something to James Gunn's skills and intelligence as writer and director in bringing depth to these comic book characters and in balancing comedy, drama, and CG Marvel movie spectacle, that these films give you license for letting go and having fun without feeling that you've indulged in the intellectual equivalent of eating an entire box of marshmallow peeps in one sitting. I will say this. In reviewing the first Guardians, I admitted to some confusion over the family ties depicted in the film. There were sisters and surrogate fathers and impromptu family connections being formed. My thought then was that it was a bit of minor sloppiness in the writing, probably having to do with syncing the film up with the Marvel franchise as it existed in comics at the time. Now, I'm not so sure. The big thing in Volume 2 is the revelation of Peter Quill's, a.k.a. Star-Lord's, real father, who turns out to be a sentient planet who, for a hobby, has taken the form of Kurt Russell. This means that Quill, still played with amiable doofiness by Chris Pratt, now has something on the order of three real and surrogate fathers, four if you want to count David Hasselhoff, and who wouldn't, plus the funky bunch that forms his Guardians family and whose structure here is rejiggered a little bit to incorporate some romance and a sibling reconciliation. As I noted in my previous review, one of the kinkier ideas of Guardians is that while we Earthlings are going on with our drab, constrained little lives, all sorts of madness is going on elsewhere in the universe. And I'm beginning to think that Gunn is suggesting that part of that chaos is the notion of family. I, in having rejected the concept of an active, organizing intelligence to the universe, take comfort in the idea that we all originally stemmed from the same source. We, along with every particle in existence, were all literally one at the beginning. And I think in depicting the chaos of relations in Guardians, Gunn is trying to point out how narrow our, and by our I mean us Americans, conventional view of the family is. We are still all one in the end, and still one with the universe. There is, of course, also the fact that mainstream films frequently play the "it's all about family" card in order to give themselves an emotional gravity they otherwise don't really deserve. Gunn may be paying lip service to that, but I think he's also pushing beyond it to something more intriguing and definitely more welcome. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 doesn't lean heavily on the concept, but it is something that pushes this joyously tumultuous movie past just being amusing eye candy. The main character in the Russian film, The Student, doesn't have time for amusements. A budding teen sociopath, he's landed on his own read of fundamentalist Christianity, and over the course of the film deploys Bible quotes and his own charismatic will to sow chaos among befuddled educators, amused classmates, and a disabled and idolizing acolyte. There is an unanticipated relevance in watching a malignant personality blithely run over the social contract for his own ends. But beyond that, director and co-writer Kirill Serebrennikov deploys his star Pyotr Skvortsov in a fantastic performance to both take down the hypocrisies of religious fervor and explore how, against a truly toxic intelligence, good intentions